I would like to start by reading from a heart released pieces from Ajahn Mun, translated by Ajahn Jeff. I would like to start by reading Ajahn Jeff's introduction, a short essay called The Customs of the Noble Ones, the story of a Thai forest tradition. Throughout its history, Buddhism has worked as a civilizing force. Its teaching on karma, for instance, the principle that all intentional actions have consequences, have taught morality and compassion to many societies. But on a deeper level, Buddhism has always straddled the line between civilization and wilderness. The Buddha himself gained awakening in a forest, gave his first sermon in a forest, and passed away in a forest. The qualities of mind he needed in order to survive physically and mentally as he went, unarmed, into the wilds, were key to his discovery of the Dhamma. They included resilience, resolve, and alertness, self-honesty and circumspection, steadfastness in the face of loneliness, courage and ingenuity in the face of external dangers, compassion and respect for the other inhabitants of the forest. These qualities formed the home culture of the Dhamma. Periodically, as Buddhism spread and adapted to different societies, some practitioners felt that the original message of the Dhamma had become diluted, so they returned to the wilderness in order to revive its home culture. Many wilderness traditions are still alive today, especially in the Theravada countries of Sri Lanka and Southeast Asia. There, mendicant ascetic monks continue to wander through the remaining rainforests in search of awakening in the same environment where the Buddha found awakening himself. Among these wilderness traditions, the one that has attracted the largest number of Western students and is beginning to take root in the West is the Kamatana meditation forest tradition of Thailand. The Kamatana tradition was founded by Ajahn Mun Buridhato in the early decades of this century. Ajahn Mun's mode of practice was solitary and strict. He followed the Vinaya, monastic discipline, faithfully, and also observed many of what are known as the 13 classic Dutanga ascetic practices, such as living off alms food, wearing robes made of cast-off rags, dwelling in the forest, eating only one meal a day. Searching out secluded places in the wilds of Thailand and Laos, he avoided the responsibilities of settled monastic life and spent long hours of the day and night in meditation. In spite of his reclusive nature, he attracted a large following of students willing to put up with the hardships of forest life in order to study with him. He also had his detractors, who accused him of not following traditional Thai Buddhist customs. He usually responded by saying that he wasn't interested in bending to the customs of any particular society, as they were, by definition, the customs of people with greed, anger, and delusion in their minds. He was more interested in finding and following the Dhamma's home culture, or what he called the customs of the noble ones, the practices that had enabled the Buddha and his disciples to achieve awakening in the first place. This phrase, the customs of the noble ones, comes from an incident in the Buddha's life. Not long after his awakening, he returned to his hometown in order to teach the Dhamma to the family he had left 6 years earlier. After spending the night in a forest, he went for alms in town at daybreak. His father, the king, learned of this and immediately went to upbraid him. "This is shameful," the king said. "No one in the lineage of our family has ever gone begging. It's against our family customs." "Your Majesty," the Buddha replied, "I now belong not to the lineage of my family, but to the lineage of the noble ones. Theirs are the customs I follow." Ajahn Mun devoted many years of his life to tracking those customs down. Born in 1870, the son of rice farmers in the northeastern province of Ubon, he was ordained as a monk in the provincial capital in 1892. At the time of his ordination, there were two broad types of Buddhism available in Thailand. The first can be called customary Buddhism, the mores and rites handed down over the centuries from teacher to teacher with little, if any, reference to the Pali Canon. For the most part, these customs taught monks to live a sedentary life in the village monastery, serving the local villagers as doctors or fortune tellers. Monastic discipline tended to be loose. Occasionally, monks would go on a pilgrimage they called, quote, Dutanga, which bore little resemblance to the classic Dutanga practices. Instead, it was more an undisciplined escape valve for the pressures of sedentary life. Moreover, monks and lay people practiced forms of meditation that deviated from the path of tranquility and insight outlined in the Pali Canon. The practices, called Wicca Akham, or incantation knowledge, involved initiations and invocations used for shamanistic purposes, such as protective charms and magical powers. They rarely mention Nibbana except as an entity to be invoked for shamanic rites. The second type of Buddhism available at the time was Reform Buddhism. Based on the Pali Canon and begun in the 1820s by Prince Mongkut, who later became King Rama IV, and later was portrayed in the musical The King and I. Prince Mongkut was ordained as a monk for 27 years before ascending the throne. After studying the canon during his early years as a monk, he grew discouraged by the level of practice he saw around him in Thai monasteries. So he reordained among the Mons, an ethnic group that straddled the Thai-Burmese border and occupied a few villages across the river from Bangkok, and studied Vinaya and the classic Dutanga practices under the guidance of a Mon teacher. Later, his brother, King Rama III, complained that it was disgraceful for members of the royal family to join an ethnic minority, and so built a monastery for the prince monk on the Bangkok side of the river. There, Mongkut attracted a small but strong following of like-minded monks and lay supporters, and in this way the Dhamma Ute, literally in accordance with the Dhamma, movement was born. In its early years, the Dhamma Ute movement was an informal grouping devoted to Pali studies, focusing on Vinaya, the classic Dutanga practices, a rationalist interpretation of the Dhamma, and the revival of meditation techniques taught in the Pali Canon, such as recollection of the Buddha and mindfulness of the body. None of the movement's members, however, could prove that the teachings of the Pali Canon actually led to enlightenment. Mongkut himself was convinced that the path to Nibbana was no longer open, but he felt that a great deal of merit could be made by reviving at least the outward forms of the earliest Buddhist traditions. Formally taking a bodhisattva vow, he dedicated the merit of his efforts to future Buddhahood. Many of his students also took vows, hoping to become disciples of that future Buddha. Upon disrobing and ascending the throne after his brother's death in 1851, Rama IV was in a position to impose his reforms on the rest of the Thai Sangha, but chose not to. Instead, he quietly sponsored the building of new Dhamma Ute centers in the capital and the provinces, which was how, by the time of Ajahn Mun, there came to be a handful of Dhamma Ute monasteries in Ubon. Ajahn Mun felt that customary Buddhism had little to offer, and so he joined the Dhamma Ute order, taking a student of Prince Mongkut as his preceptor. Unlike many who joined the order at that time, he wasn't interested in the social advancement that would come with academic study and ecclesiastical appointments. Instead, his life on the farm had impressed upon him the suffering inherent in the cycle of birth and death, and his single aim was to find a way out of that cycle. As a result, he soon left the scholarly environment of his preceptor's temple and went to live with a teacher named Ajahn Sao Kantasilo, who lived from 1861 to 1941, in a small meditation monastery on the outskirts of town. Ajahn Sao was unusual in the Dhamma Ute order in that he had no scholarly interests, but was devoted to the practice of meditation. He trained Ajahn Mun in strict discipline and canonical meditation practices set in the context of the dangers and solitude of the wilderness. He could not guarantee that this practice would lead to the noble attainments, but he believed that it headed in the right direction. After wandering for several years with Ajahn Sao, Ajahn Mun set off on his own in search of a teacher who could show him for sure the way to lead to the noble attainments. His search took nearly 2 decades and involved countless hardships as he trekked through the jungles of Laos, central Thailand, and Burma, but he never found the teacher he sought. Gradually, he realized that he would have to follow the Buddha's example and take the wilderness itself as his teacher, not simply to conform to the ways of nature, for nature is samsara already, but to break through to truths transcending them entirely. If he wanted to find the way beyond aging, illness, and death, he would have to learn the lessons of an environment where aging, illness, and death are thrown into sharp relief. At the same time, his encounters with other monks in the forest convinced him that learning the lessons of the wilderness involved more than just mastering the skills of physical survival. He would also have to develop the acuity not to be misled by dead-end sidetracks in his meditation. So, with a strong sense of the immensity of his task, he returned to a mountainous region in central Thailand and settled alone in a cave. In the long course of his wilderness training, Ajahn Mun learned that, contrary to reform and customary beliefs, the path to Nibbana was not closed. The true Dhamma was to be found not in old customs or texts, but in the well-trained heart and mind. The texts were pointers for training, nothing more or less. The rules of the Vinaya, instead of simply being external customs, played an important role in physical and mental survival. As for the Dhamma texts, practice was not just a matter of confirming what they said. Reading and thinking about the texts could not give an adequate understanding of what they meant and did not count as showing them true respect. True respect for the texts meant taking them as a challenge, putting their teaching seriously to the test to see if, in fact, they are true. In the course of testing the teachings, the mind would come to many unexpected realizations that were not contained in the texts. These, in turn, had to be put to the test as well, so that one learned gradually by trial and error to the point of an actual noble attainment. Only then, Ajahn Mun would say, did one understand the Dhamma. This attitude toward the Dhamma parallels what ancient cultures called warrior knowledge, the knowledge that comes from developing skills in difficult situations, as opposed to the scribe knowledge that people sitting in relative security and ease can write down in words. Of course, warriors need to use words in their training, but they view a text as authoritative only if its teachings are borne out in practice. The canon itself encourages this attitude when it quotes the Buddha as teaching his aunt, "As for the teachings of which you know, these teachings lead to dispassion, not to passion, to being unfettered, not to being fettered, to divesting, not to accumulating, to modesty, not to self-aggrandizement, to contentment, not to discontent, to seclusion, not to entanglement, to aroused persistence, not to laziness, to being unburdensome, not to being burdensome. You may definitely hold, this is the Dhamma, this is the Vinaya, this is the teacher's instruction." Thus, the ultimate authority in judging a teaching is not whether the teaching can be found in a text. It lies in each person's relentless honesty in putting the Dhamma to the test and carefully monitoring the results. When Ajahn Mun had reached the point where he could guarantee that the path to the noble attainments was still open, he returned to the northeast to inform Ajahn Sao and then to continue wandering. Gradually, he began to attract a grassroots following. People who met him were impressed by his demeanor and teachings, which were unlike those of any other monks they had known. They believed that he embodied the Dhamma and Vinaya in everything he did and said. As a teacher, he took a warrior's approach to training his students. Instead of simply imparting verbal knowledge, he put them into situations where they would have to develop the qualities of mind and character needed in surviving the battle with their own defilements. Instead of teaching a single meditation technique, he taught them a full panoply of skills. As one student said, quote, "everything from washing spittoons on up." And then he sent them into the wilds. It was after Ajahn Mun's return to the northeast that a third type of Buddhism emanating from Bangkok, state Buddhism, began to impinge on his life. In an effort to present a united front in the face of imperialist threats from Britain and France, Rama V, 1868 to 1910, wanted to move their country from a loose feudal system to a centralized nation-state. As part of his program, he and his brothers, one of whom was ordained as a monk, enacted religious reforms to prevent the encroachment of Christian missionaries. Having received their education from British tutors, they created a new monastic curriculum that subjected the Dhamma and Vinaya to Victorian notions of reason and utility. Their new version of the Vinaya, for instance, was a compromise between customary and reform Buddhism designed to counter Christian attacks that monks were unreliable and lazy. Monks were instructed to give up their wanderings, settle in established monasteries, and accept the new state curriculum. Because the Dhammayut monks were the best educated in Thailand at the time and had the closest connections to the royal family, they were enlisted to do advance work for the government in outlying regions. In 1928, a Dhammayut authority unsympathetic to meditation and forest wanderers took charge of religious affairs in the Northeast. Trying to domesticate Ajahn Mun's following, he ordered them to establish monasteries and help propagate the government's program. Ajahn Mun and a handful of his students left for the north, where they were still free to roam. In the early 1930s, Ajahn Mun was appointed the abbot of an important monastery in the city of Chiang Mai, but fled the place before dawn of the following day. He returned to settle in the Northeast only in the very last years of his life, after the local ecclesiastical authorities had grown more favorably disposed to his way of practice. He maintained many of his Dutanga practices up to his death in 1949. It wasn't until the 1950s that the movement he founded gained acceptance in Bangkok, and only in the 1970s did it come into prominence on a nationwide level. This coincided with a widespread loss of confidence in state monks, many of whom were little more than bureaucrats in robes. As a result, Kamatana monks came to represent, in the eyes of many monastics and laypeople, a solid and reliable expression of the Dhamma in a world of fast and furious modernization. Buddhist history has shown that wilderness traditions go through a very quick life cycle. As one loses its momentum, another one often grows up in its place. But with the wholesale destruction of Thailand's forests in the last few decades, the Kamatana tradition may be the last great forest tradition that Thailand will produce. Fortunately, we in the West have learned of it in time to gather lessons that will be helpful in cultivating the customs of the noble ones on Western soil and establishing authentic wilderness traditions of our own. Perhaps the most important of those lessons concerns the role that the wilderness plays in testing and correcting trends that develop among Buddhists in cities and towns. The story of the Kamatana tradition gives lie to the facile notion that Buddhism has survived simply by adapting to its host culture. The survival of Buddhism and the survival of the Dhamma are two different things. People like Ajahn Mun, willing to make whatever sacrifices are needed to discover and practice the Dhamma on its own terms, are the ones who have kept the Dhamma alive. Of course, people have always been free to engage in Buddhist traditions in whatever way they like, but those who have benefited most from that engagement are those who, instead of reshaping Buddhism to fit their preferences, reshape themselves to fit in with the customs and traditions of the noble ones. To find these customs isn't easy, given the bewildering variety of traditions that Buddhists have spawned over the centuries. To test them, each individual is thrown back on his or her own powers of relentless honesty, integrity, and discernment. There are no easy guarantees. And perhaps this fact in itself is a measure of the Dhamma's true worth. Only people of real integrity can truly comprehend it. As Ajahn Lee, one of Ajahn Mun's students, once said, "If a person isn't true to the Buddha's teachings won't be true to that person, and that person won't be able to know what the Buddha's true teachings are." The second thing I'd like to read is from the collection Kuba Ajahn, put together by Ajahn Chandako and translated by Ajahn Chandako, I believe. This is about Ajahn Thanajan Tongrat, who is a disciple of Ajahn Mun and a teacher of Ajahn Shah, And it was related to the monks from Wat Phananashat by Longpo Gi, who was a disciple of Thanachan Tongrat. Or is. He might be still alive, I don't know. Is he still alive, Longpo Gi?
Oh, no, he died 20 years ago, more. I think before Ajahn Chah.
Oh, okay.
Around that time. I think before, just before.
Thanachan Tongrat Kantasilo was a disciple of Longpo Manbury Datta and Longpo Sao Kantasilo. He was of the same generation of disciples as Thanachan Singh Kantayamo and Thanachan Du Achalatamo. He was born at Sampong village and ordained at the village monastery. He stayed there 5 pansas and learned the Padimokkha. However, he still had some doubts regarding the Vinaya. Because he couldn't understand the meaning of some of the rules, he began to search for a Krupa Ajahn who could clarify the matter. After hearing of the reputations of Longpo Mun and Longpo Sao, he set off traveling to pay respects to, study with, and converse with them. Both the teachers explained the essentials of correct practice, practice in line with Dhamma and Vinaya, from the Patthasambhut, a 19th century Thai commentarial classic in verse form, and the Vinaya texts, until Venerable Tongrat understood. He was so satisfied with the explanations that he asked to become their disciple and stay at their monastery. Both of the Venerable Ajahns trained him, instructing him to practice in accordance with the Vinaya and all its details. Concerning the practice of meditation, Longpo Mun and Longpo Sao recommended that Venerable Tongrat go and find a place in the forest suitable for Bhavana, especially a place with tigers, or that was rumored to have a malevolent ghost. The best would be a cremation ground that had corpses carried in each day, so that the citta would become unwaveringly firm and Dhamma would quickly arise. They recommended that he study the Buddhist texts Visuddhimagga and Mun Mahakan. These were to be studied only in order to have a well-rounded understanding, not to be memorized in order to give Dhamma talks. Both of the Ajahns reiterated, "Don't go giving Dhamma talks, Venerable Tong. First meditate until you've accomplished in Bhavana. If you're in too much of a hurry to give Dhamma talks, the Dhamma inside won't have a chance to do any teaching." Thanachan Tongrat then practiced, strictly following their advice. Life in the jungle was one of extreme impoverishment. The 4 requisites were in short supply. There were no cups, no kettles. He had to use a section of bamboo and drill a hole in it to thread a shoulder strap. He had to filter his drinking water. On alms round, he'd only get plain rice. When it was time to eat, he'd chew it thoroughly. On those days when he'd get 1 banana, he'd be elated. The villagers weren't very clued in. Generally, they understood that meditation monks didn't eat meat, that they only ate sesame seeds like people from India. He'd go on alms round to 4 or 5 houses, get enough rice to fill him up, and then quit. He didn't have a cloak. If there were lots of mosquitoes, then he would cover himself with his robe folded in half. The sangati was used in place of a pillow or blanket. Sometimes he would sleep with his head resting on a root of a tree or on his own fist. On those times when he'd stay near where the villagers threshed their rice, he could ask for some old rice stalks to roll up in a bundle, cover it with a folded cloth, and use that as a pillow. If a villager happened by, he could help by breaking off a branch so the leaves could be used. He would even take some vines, tie them together, and cover them with a bathing cloth, and that would substitute for a pillow. Lying down, he would focus on his bhavana. Sometimes the water buffalo herders would pass by, and finding him sitting in the cremation ground, they'd tease him and make fun of him in various ways. "Is this monk crazy or what? He's been sitting here for 2 or 3 days." Some people would approach, bow to him, then pretending to be serious, ask in jest, "Would you like to chew some betel nut? Do you smoke cigarettes, Ajahn?" Ajahn would respond, "If there is some, I chew it. If not, I don't. If there are any, I smoke them. If not, I don't." This is just one example, but they were just asking to ask. Not once did they actually offer him anything. There were a few occasions when some villagers would come and request Dhamma teachings. "Teach us some Dhamma, Venerable. I'm still new to the practice. My Krupa Ajahns won't allow me to give Dhamma talks yet." Well, what about that book you've got there? Give us a Dhamma teaching from the book. They gave me this book simply for me to read, telling me not to use it for Dhamma talks. They told me to wait for the Dhamma inside to express itself, then start teaching others, he explained to the villagers, in the same way as his Krupa Ajahn had stressed so emphatically to him. He did, however, give the villagers the five precepts so that they would be satisfied with having made merit. Venerable Tongrut practiced and developed meditation like this for 4 years. Only very rarely did he go to pay his respects to his teachers, and then for only 2 or 3 days or maybe a week. Once he'd heard some Dhamma teachings, they'd chase him back out there to meditate, and the places they'd sent him to were all fear-inspiring. Staying in the forest for extended periods of time, his possessions became old and worn. His bathing cloth was ripped. His jiwan was disintegrated. No one offered to provide him with requisites, and he didn't have any relatives there. He couldn't ask lay people to provide things because it was against the Vinaya, so when his robes ripped, he'd mend them. There were patches everywhere. He spent a lot of time sewing, and the thread he'd brought with him ran out. When he found some yellow bark on a tree that had recently died, he'd take a knife and gently pare it off. Once the bark was stripped off, he'd weave it into the robe. Each time he bathed, he had to wait until there were no women in the area. He'd bathe in the forest, hopping just like a frog. As things got increasingly worse, Venerable Tongrut began to think of his home. He missed his two younger sisters and his older brother, a government official at Sampong Village. He came up with the idea to return and spend the Pansa at his home village. That way he could ask for some cloth from his younger sister. But when he went to respectfully present the idea to his two teachers, Lompor Mun immediately scolded him. Ha! So you said you wanted to receive some Dhamma from the teachers Mun and Sao, but after a little bit of practice you get homesick. Your house's pillars at Sampong are firmly sunk into the earth. Whenever you go back there, they'll be there for you to see. What's difficult is this practice of Dhamma. That is, if you haven't yet realized Dhamma. Your house is just the same as it always was. You want to attain Magga Mpala. Do you think that longing for your home while meditating will do the trick? His Krupa Ajahn repeated this 2 or 3 times in a similar manner. Fearing further reprimands from his teacher, Tan Tongrut took leave and returned to meditate for a few days. Taking into consideration how his teacher spoke to him, he reflected on what the best thing to do would be. Once he thought it through, he went back to pay his respects again. "Excuse me, Venerable Sir, where are you going to have me spend Vasa this year? It's already July, so please give the matter some consideration." Lompor Mung sat and focused his mind internally, then said, "Prabhot Cave, Tan Tong. Go and stay at Prabhot Cave, all right?" "Prabhot Cave? Everyone who goes and stays there dies." "If they don't die, they go mad. They become crippled. That's what they say. How can you send me there to stay? What will protect me?" "The 4 Brahma Viharas. This is what should be done." "Can you handle it, Tan Tong?" "Yes, sir." "Okay, that's the spirit. May your practice progress, Tan Tong." That Pansa, there was no choice but to go stay at Prabhot Cave. He stayed in the cavern, meditating in solitude. If he heard the sound of owls calling each other, he'd lay down to sleep. The forest birds signaled the beginning of a new day when they left to look for food, calling out to each other, "Chai, chai." Emerging from the cave, he'd walk cross-country through the mist about 4 kilometers and then some before he reached the place for going on alms round. If he walked briskly, he could get there in an hour. Walking slowly, it took longer than that. Time rolled by until a full moon of September. Traditionally, on full moon days, the villagers would go to the monastery to make merit. It was a bright, clear night as Venerable Tongrut sat in meditation inside the cave. At that moment, there occurred a loud noise, loud crashing sounds. Fear began to arise. What could those possibly be stomping down the mountainsides toward him? Whatever they were, when they reached the mouth of the cave, they jumped down, grabbed each other, and began to wrestle. Their deafening yells reverberated throughout the mountain, and it shook as if it were about to collapse. Venerable Tongrut thought he'd go and have a look to see what was making the noise. He almost went. Then he thought, if I go out there, I'll probably die just like all the others in the stories I've heard. Furthermore, whatever they're doing, that's their own business. Whether it's an animal, a ghost, or an evil spirit, that's not my business. I came here to meditate, so I'll just carry on with my practice. We don't have to have anything to do with each other. Once he considered it in this way, he could continue on focusing his mind. But every hair was standing on end. He sat there watching his mind. From that moment on, Venerable Tongrut's meditation became truly accomplished. The Dhamma gushed forth. As the Dhamma arose, so did an irresistible desire to teach the Dhamma. So he sat there all alone giving a Dhamma talk. For 7 days and 7 nights, he continued on. Even if someone had tried to sew his mouth shut, the needle probably would have broken, or else his mouth would have ripped. He was proclaiming the dispensation of the Lord Buddha. He thundered against the corrupt monks of his time, especially those who abused positions of power. It wasn't enough just to teach within the borders of Thailand, so as he taught, his words reached foreign lands as well, Malaysia, England, and other Western countries. The Dhamma teachings flowed forth. Each day he only ate 3 bites of food, one for the Buddha, one for the Dhamma, and one for the Sangha. He taught untiringly with no need of sleep. Completely alone, he gave Dhamma talks day and night like a maniac, getting thinner all the time. Tanajan, are you feeling sick? A layman asked him on alms round. No. Are you able to eat all right? Just fine. Suspicious, the layman thought to himself, I can't believe that if he's able to eat that, he's not sick. He's so thin, his eyes have sunken deeply. I better follow him and have a look. The man secretly followed Venerable Tongrut back, and sure enough, he saw the monk eat just 3 mouthfuls of food, one for the Buddha, one for the Dhamma, and one for the Sangha. The layman then protested, How can you tell me you have no problem eating, that you're not sick? You only eat 3 bites. You're so thin, your eyes are hollow and empty. Why did you deceive me? Listening to the man, Tanajan reconsidered. With his hair standing on end, he suddenly realized, I misled him, and he returned to focusing awareness on his citta. From that time on, his heart had reached fulfillment, but he still had this desire to give Dhamma talks. He eagerly awaited the end of the pansa, so he could go tell Lompo Man. It was only 2 days after the end of pansa before he arrived to see his teacher and recount all his experiences. He described the various states of mind that had occurred and all that had taken place. Once he finished telling his story, Lompo Man concluded, that's good, Tan Tong. Your citta is now at the same level as my own. Now you can teach, Venerable Tong. Teach to your heart's content. Uncover your platter of rice for all to see. Teach the Dhamma. There's now no need to fear teaching. Reveal it all, just as if you were serving a feast. From that point on, Tanajan Tongrat wandered about looking for situations to teach the Dhamma. Around the villages of Tanton and Pujan, there were large communities and large audiences for his Dhamma talks. At that time, he became a constant companion of Lompo Sao. He felt a debt of gratitude to his teacher for all he'd given him. Whenever Lompo Sao asked him to accompany him, he'd go. Wherever he was asked to stay, he'd stay. Having gone to Ubon, Lompo Sao requested Tanajan Tongrut to spend the pansa at Siton, saying, There are many good people here. There are many bad as well. Until Lompo Sao's passing away, Tanajan Tongrut attended on and served him. When I later asked Tanajan Tongrut about his practice experiences during that 10th pansa in Prapot Cave, the answer was brief. It was like I had climbed to the top of the tallest tree. There was nowhere else to go. How would you describe the citta of a person who has finished their spiritual work? Sati pasati, mindfulness and tranquility. Sati is ever present. The deep peace of pasati is ever present. In the citta, there are no thoughts of harming. It's just like a water buffalo that has been trained to plow the rice paddies. When it's time to turn around, it turns by itself. You don't have to pull on its rope much. For anyone who's cared for their citta to this extent, the citta then takes care of itself.
Venerable Pisolo, who authored the second piece?
It was told by Lopur Di, who was a student of Ajahn Tongran. It was told to the monks at Wat Namacha, and that piece was translated by Ajahn Chandaka.
And that's the only place that exists. I don't think it's even in the... Because there's a biography of Ajahn Tongran that Ajahn Bhutan wrote. I don't think that story is in there.
Or did any of the Wapapo monks spend time with Lopurgi at all?
Not much. They'd go and pay respects. He lived quite close to the kind of market town of people, so that it wasn't such a quiet. It wasn't right close, but it wasn't that far away. So there were a lot of, say, more salubrious situations. It's sort of similar where, sort of like Ajahn Beeks, where, you know, sets up way out of town, and then the town grows and starts to impinge on the one place. Actually, Ajahn Aneks is similar as well. He was sort of this little monastery way out of town, and now it's fairly close.
How much time did Ajahn Chah spend with Ajahn Tongran?
Ajahn Dhanasaro has... It's quite interesting, because he used to go and visit him from time to time. And it was understood that he never spent punta with him. But then as Ajahn Dhanasaro was doing more research, I think he figured out that he must have spent a punta with him. But he wasn't that far away, so that when he was at early days of Wapapo, and I think maybe even before that, Ajahn Tongran was, you know, had a reputation, so that he would go and visit him. And even when he was on Tudong, if he'd go back to Ubon, which wasn't all that often, he would swing by and visit Ajahn Tongran.
There was a period when I was at, during the 5 months I was at Wat Bapong, for maybe 2 or 3 weeks, and Lopur Lien was talking about Ajahn Tongran during every one of his avadas.
Uh-huh.
And over and over again he was saying that Ajahn Tongran had made this prophecy that he said, like, now in the future the forest monks will be like village monks, and the village monks will be like lay people, something like that. It's interesting.
In the first piece, I'm not sure if he was saying this, but it sounded like he was describing a situation in Thailand where there's nobody that had any noble attainments. Was that fair to read, or is that?
It's a fair assumption. The communications weren't all that great, so that. But in terms of readily accessible, didn't seem to be anybody around.
You mentioned that book, Chalkunupali. It starts off with the question and answer period. Someone's asking him questions and says, "You know, do you follow the school of enlightenment? Is impossible anymore? It's closed off, or the enlightenment is possible, or it doesn't matter. Just practice." And he says, "Yeah, I follow all three." If you take the first view, well, at least the teachings are here, so you better practice, because in the future, you might know when there's a real Buddha in the second school as well. Okay, it's available, so I better take advantage of it. And the third one is, obviously, it's better to practice than not to practice.
Right,
yeah. Level three.
Yeah, since I sort of speculated in the biography that just forest monks, you know, rose and passed, and maybe there was a charismatic leader, and just there wasn't much knowledge about whether, you know, whether these actually people existed or not, but it was possible that there were generations of monks and then they die out, but they were unknown, they weren't heard of.
Oh, sure, yeah, but
hard to find.
Not within the accessible, easily accessible. And certainly there's, you know, rise and fall of the popularity or interest in the practice. But certainly in Thailand there's early days. I mean, prior to radio and television, very difficult to know what was going on in many places, although certainly Prince Mongkut would have had more resources than most. But he was a personality type. He was a serious doubter. I think he. I can't remember how many ordinations he took.
Seven.
Yeah.
Seven reordinations.
Seven ordinations, because he started to worry about the purity of the ordination, trying to.
So is there any Dharma teaching material of Rongpo Thongmas available? I am not familiar with
it. No. There's a biography that the only thing that exists in it's way before the time. He died in probably 1950s. Yeah, probably 1950s. If he had say Ajahn Chah hadn't known him, then say his group of monks wouldn't have known him, and you know, he would have been forgotten, even though he had at the time he had a fairly decent following. Because also I think like nearby where Ajahn Jayasaro's hermitage is, there was an old monk. Can't remember his name now. Anyway, he passed away probably 10 years ago. But he was I'm pretty sure he was a disciple of Ajahn Thongpa. After Ajahn Jayasaro started to settle in, then he heard about this old forest monk that was nearby. Mm-hmm. And then he went to pay respects and found out he studied with Ajahn Thongpa. He died in his 90s. Very, very lovely monk. There's no record of any of these people.
Has the Ajahn Uttain biography been translated into English?
No. 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 God, we can't even get Ajahn Chah's biography in English.
Is Ajahn Uttain's monastery Ajahn Thongrat's?
Yes. That was where Ajahn Thongrat lived for toward the end of his life, and so that it was being there was a little shrine to commemorate his that he lived there, but it was kind of falling apart, and all the the forest around was all getting eaten up by the villagers, taking and sort of making it into their fields, and so that it was going to disappear. So Ajahn Lee went and had monks go and stay there, and then started to negotiate with the villagers to buy back the land and establish a monastery to protect it, and then to refurbish the jetty and the shrine. It's not really a jetty, it's not that big, with the idea that it may make a larger jetty in the future. Okay, we'll go for our next meeting. Anybody else can do a puja?